It's Bootstrapped Web. We are back. We've got a lot to talk about today. Jordan, what's up, buddy?
Hey, Brian. Hey.
Hey.
We want to start off this podcast by dedicating this episode to Ian Landsman.
Yes, Ian, this is for you.
Is fighting for the rights of people who aren't worth $80 million to express themselves on Twitter.
Ian's fighting the good fight over there.
Oh, my God. So we're trying to control our laughter here going into this episode. We're gonna do our best. This is why we have an editor. Brian and I are talking about Hay and all the comedy around it. It's a good amount of comedy. Very entertaining.
It has taken over the Twitterverse this week, for sure. It's not like anything else is happening in the world right now.
Yes. Well, we could focus on that, or we could focus on Hay. There are some interesting topics around it. It is comical in a way and very serious in other ways. It can be seen as like extremely wealthy people complaining. That's part of the comedy. But also it can be seen as someone who really doesn't give a shit and has the ability to express frustration where other people are very scared to express it. That's very useful.
Basically, it's a controversy that has really erupted this week between Hay and like the Basecamp company versus Apple and the way that they demand like in-app purchases for certain types of apps. And we'll get into it. I think everybody has been fascinated with just the launch of Hay, even before all this erupted. I was totally tuned in. Like, I'm fascinated by the way the Basecamp guys, Jason Fried and DHH and their whole team, like execute the building and launching of a brand new product from one of the most well-known software companies out there. And I thought that the way that they've been executing and rolling out the launch has been really, really good, I guess, up until this iOS app fiasco. But like, and some would argue that
yes,
has helped as well. But
you can argue that was also part of the plan, which some people are suggesting. I don't look at it that way. I'm gonna assume good intent.
Yeah. And you know, as a product designer, I think you and I have both tried out Hay at this point. And I also have some thoughts on the product itself. Like, I watched some demos of it before I started using Hay, and I was convinced that I would become a paying customer. And then after about a day of playing with it and testing it out, I uncovered a few things that to me, I think are just deal breakers. I can't.
And are they missing features, or are they the point of view on the product itself?
I think a little bit of both. And what fascinates me about this is trying to think about it from the perspective of a customer, because I deal with trying to convert customers on Process Kit every single day. I'm reminded that there's always this gap, no matter how good you are at talking to customers. And I love talking to customers and doing the demo calls and everything. And like, I'm hungry for customer research. And I think I get a lot of good customer research, but there's always a gap between what the customer is even able to tell you or demonstrate to you versus what actually truly matters to them once they're in the product. And there are always things that they don't even know themselves until they're in it. And I experienced that myself with Hay. I was like, I'm sold. I see all these features, how they were, you know, pre-launching them and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, awesome. Like, they solve a lot of problems for me from Gmail. And once I got in there, I can get into it, but in practice for me, it was like, I can't use this every day.
Yeah, it's interesting to see a mature software company launch a new product, because at least I associate the maturity of a software product with the trade-offs of, it's not that you're unaware of what users want, it's just that you can't satisfy all of them. So there are just going to be gaps no matter what. Right, we get things every day. Hey, this would make sense if you could add this. And we look at it and we say, yes, that would make sense. Are we going to add it? No. Right. So that's like the trade-off. But new products, it's a different thing. It's like, what did you decide to put in versus leave out? Like, what's your priority list? And does it match up with what my needs are? And I think that's the gap you're talking to. And it'll be interesting to see how much they behave like a, let's call it, traditional software company that listens to their users and adds features based on that, versus their very opinionated selves of very happily repelling people away if it's not right for them. They have a very large list, right? I think it's about 100,000 that have requested I saw a tweet this morning from DHH saying we sent another 10,000. The problem is we have another 70,000 waiting. So I'm going to assume somewhere around 100,000. This is a pretty unique case in that you have a software company that has built up a tremendous amount of goodwill, like a preposterous amount of goodwill through their content and leadership and ideas and everything. But they didn't launch a new product for a while. So it was, okay, a lot of people knew them and some people ended up using their product and most didn't. But the combination of the two still created a gigantic customer base. And now it's a new product. So potentially new customer base. I mean, if I had to guess off the bat, I would say that Hey is going to become a wildly successful $100 million a year plus product that I don't use. A lot like Basecamp.
I think I could agree with that. The iOS thing is a big deal. But I just wanted to mention, because I'm curious to hear other people's thoughts on this. I tweeted about this too, but just about the product itself. Like I was sold on these aspects of it, that the thoughtful UI and UX, like generally I'm always a fan of the way that they, what I'm talking about is the user experience. I'm not such a fan of like the styling, and I think it's a little bit too heavy-handed on the colors and that kind of stuff. A little cartoony for an everyday email app. I need it to be as clean and simple as possible, and it's not quite that. But the experience and the functionality in the UI makes a lot of sense, I think. The screening in, I was sold on this idea. I love the idea of not completely relying on machine learning, like the way that like Google does, just making it like user-defined screening. Yes. In, you know? Yeah. So
do you use Priority Inbox?
I don't.
You don't?
Okay. I don't use tabs.
I don't use tabs either. I use Priority Inbox and I'm relying on that machine learning and it has been failing me repeatedly over the past few months. People that I have emailed with in the past and their important emails don't go to the Priority Inbox, and emails that I don't care about and I've never responded to and are clearly cold emails with unsubscribe links get into my Priority Inbox. It sucks.
I've just never trusted Priority Inbox or tabs or any of that. And I don't know that I will. And so that's what I liked about their approach to screening in. The other thing I was intrigued by was the reply later workflow. They get it that like everybody is like just marking an email as unread, but you're shoehorning this feature that not supposed to work that way. And then the feed, this isn't talked about enough, but I like their idea of putting stuff into the feed, like newsletters and just, you know, things that don't require action that you just want to read. I'm sure I'm not alone here. I subscribe to a lot of things and I want to remain subscribed to them. But after receiving them for years, I start to naturally tune them out, which means I habitually ignore them and I don't read the stuff anymore. And treating all that stuff as an actual feed, just like a Twitter feed, I think makes a lot of sense because it would actually get me to read at least a little bit more of those emails than I, instead of like completely not opening them for years.
Right, or skim or just not have them on the same plane as your actionable emails that you need to deal with.
Yeah, so here's what happened after I signed up. The screening is the big one. Number one, I wasn't thrilled that I can't import my old archives to Hey. So I have 10-year-old archives in my Gmail that I search all the time. And I'm talking about my business G Suite, which I pay for. So if I were to switch to Hey, I would still need to pay for G Suite just to keep the searchable archives. And I would have to have a separate app just to search old stuff and like from before this date. And like,
I could see them adding that as a business feature, right? They haven't launched the business version yet. And I could see bringing over archives as a business feature.
Yeah, I don't know. But the other one was the real deal breaker. And that's the way that the screening in actually works.
How does it work? You describe it. I have not set up forwarding. I haven't committed that deep.
Yeah, so kind of it's around. Pretty simple the way that it works now. It's just based on who the email is from, the from email address.
So every single email that comes into your inbox, you have to make a decision of whether this is an email you want to see versus don't? Is that straightforward that way?
If I email you once for the very first time in your Hey account, you'll screen me in once. Hopefully you'll screen me in. And then anytime I email you after that, then I don't hit your screener. I go straight into your inbox.
Okay. And what happens if I say, no, thanks, no Brian Castle for me?
Then I can send you 1,000 cold emails in the future. You won't see them.
Where do they go?
I think they do go somewhere. Like
you can, like the feed or something.
Or yeah, some other thing that you don't see, but later you could decide to unscreen me and then you will have access to that. But here's where it breaks down is I get a lot of messages via other apps. So a big one for me is Help Scout. Like I get customer support. I'm currently doing process kit customer support through Help Scout, but then those come to my personal work email that I would have used with Hey. And Help Scout, like many other apps, those emails come from a Help Scout email address, not from the user's email address. And they put like a conversation ID in the email address. So even if like the same customer sends me 10 different emails through Help Scout, those are going to hit the screener every single time because they have unique conversation IDs.
Oh, you can't just do it at the domain level?
Can't do it at the domain level. But even if I did it at the domain level, I do get some spam or some crap through Help Scout that I don't want to see that I would normally screen out. So in that case, like maybe if they could like screen in based on the reply to email instead of the from email, that could be good. Or have rules like if the email address contains a string, then screen it in. Like, you know, these get into things that maybe they'll add later. But you know, Help Scout, like Trello messages from Process Kit when we're commenting with the team, like those come from a Process Kit email. But they reply to the person's email, and like so things like that. I would have to finally like move all of my Process Kit emailing out to its own. I have Brian at processkit.com, but I'm not actively using it yet. It's still going to my main work email. So I would have to have like yet another inbox. So anyways, so that's sort of the deal breaker for me.
For me on the product, I haven't dug into it the same way. I haven't started forwarding. It's just that they spoke to the problems that I experience really well. Just the loss of control over my own inbox and it turning into a source of stress and guilt. That's what I associate my inbox right now.
If the screening in could actually work as intended, like for my use case, like it would eliminate cold email spam that I don't ever want to see.
And it would eliminate right now what I see as a giant burden of just, it's on me to unsubscribe to everything. And I've tried all those unsubscription apps and I hate all of them with a passion because they all have these tricky business models and make you share with friends. And it's like, I will just pay you to help me unsubscribe from these things. And I can't find something that just does that in a straightforward way.
Yeah, but I could see the screener. I think Ian has been making this point a lot that like, I think it will become a chore still. Like we'll still all receive cold email from people. And then our screener inbox is never going to be inbox zero. And that's
right. And that's what I rely on Priority Inbox to do for me. It just has been, you know, not as good as it has in the past. Now, look, we're talking about the product. That's all nice. But I want to talk about the contract. Come on.
Let's talk about the juicy stuff.
Right. So what happens? Basecamp, very inexperienced software company, doesn't really understand the rules of the App Store.
This is their first go at this.
Just walking down the block, innocently whistling. Walks into the Apple Store, gets clubbed in the knee, right? That's effectively what happened is they went to launch. It sounds like they actually got one version of the app in without any issues. And then when they went to update it, right, that's what happened. Then someone found it and identified it as a non-business app. Do I have that right?
See, I'm really on the fence on like, I feel like both sides are a little bit at blame here, for lack of a better word. And so Apple's stance is that they mistakenly initially approved the app.
Right.
That on it the would, first should submission. Never, it right. should have never been approved in the first place.
It should have been upfront. This type of app has to pay us 30% because...
Yes. And then a day into their launch, I don't know what day it was this week, like Tuesday or something.
Right, they went to update it with fixes.
Quick fixes. And then on that, they got denied. And the reason that Apple is saying is that an app like Hey, an email app, they don't call it an email client because it's like its own email service. I think the problem on Apple's end, according to their terms, is that there's no free version of Hey. So every user who goes through the iOS App Store and discovers Hey and downloads it, Hey does not do anything. It has no functionality for them unless they go into their web browser and go to hey.com and then subscribe and become a paying subscriber there. And what Apple is saying is like, you, they have to offer a way to in-app purchase that subscription. And Apple takes 30% of that. My understanding now, I just learned this today, that it's 30% of the first year and then 15%.
Yeah, after going forward. And that's when our boy DHH just lost his Danish mind. he went nuclear and the whole internet started pointing at it like, look at what's happening here. And the details started to become fuzzier. And what came to the front was Apple is abusing its power and taking money away that it shouldn't take away from a company like, hey, that feels like they don't have a choice but to list in the App Store, but doesn't want to pay, you know, bribe or tax as it's being positioned. Now, what's the argument?
Well, I think the general argument is that just in general, it's just way too high for Apple to take 30%. I mean, ridiculous, right? But that's something that all app developers are aware of, and a lot of them don't like it. But a lot of people say that they're smaller players, so they don't want to complain too publicly about it.
Yes, everyone's scared, and DHH has the luxury or the guts or whatever combination of things to be able to just blast away.
Yeah, and I mean, they do have a point that like Apple is so big at this point that this would be a business product killer. It's not like they could just decide like, oh, we're just not going to have an iOS app. Like for this type of, for an email tool.
You can't go to the browser all day. No way.
No.
You lose your mind.
Yeah.
It's whenever I am too sick of Twitter and addicted, I just go to the web version and that will make you never go there. The app is so good. I assume it would be the same thing with an email client. So now the tricky thing is that like 30% might make sense for a game. Like your whole business is based on distribution in the App Store and Apple wants their cut. Okay, fine. But this is separate. This is a business that has really nothing to do with Apple.
Yeah, it's like customers can go to Hey and pay $99 a year. Or if they just happened to have subscribed through Apple, then they're paying.
Right. I think that's like one of the most important parts of the whole conversation is if you go to hey.com and sign up and pay and then go to the iOS store, app store and download it, Apple's not getting a cut from that at all. Is that right?
Yes. That's
like they're only going to pay 30% for people who discover it through Apple and then make the in-app purchase from there, as opposed to
They discovered it, they maybe they did hear about it through Basecamp's other marketing. But like, if they end up subscribing through the in-app purchase, then they're paying 30% of that is going to Apple.
I think that's the weakest part of Basecamp's argument. If Apple said, and I could not help but watch this debate without thinking about the Shopify app store, obviously, because my life is dependent on a platform, also just like other people's apps are dependent on other platforms. So I was looking at it with that lens for sure. I think if a platform is saying, we don't care where you get your customers, if you work with us, if you have an integration with us and an app in our app store, we're taking a revenue share from every one of our platform customers. That's much more heavy-handed than if they discover it through us, then we deserve a cut.
Yeah, my understanding is that it's not based on like whether they discovered it. It's just whether they chose clicked the purchase button from within the iPhone app or if they just like entered their login and
like logged in.
Yeah, like logged in. Like that's what Basecamp is arguing. It's like just let our users log in with their existing login that they created over on our website. Because here's what I learned about this week. I'm still sort of trying to figure out these terms. Look, Basecamp has an iOS app, and many other business see that they make this distinction. Apple does, like business apps versus consumer apps, and the part that doesn't make a lot of sense. John Gruber had a really good blog post about this week. Is that there are too many apps, and this is a perfect example of one that is in both worlds, like a prosumer app, right? And I guess Apple's terms are, if they classify it as a business app, then you don't have to do their in-app purchase. Then you're allowed to have an app in the App Store that essentially does nothing if you download it and then you just log in with your account information. So for example, Basecamp's iPhone app that they've had for years, people don't subscribe to that through the App Store.
And Basecamp therefore doesn't give a share.
Basecamp hasn't paid Apple a dollar for that for years.
What a trip.
And so they're sort of arguing that like that, but Apple is classifying an email app more like a Gmail, which they consider to be a consumer app. And the difference between Gmail and Hey is that Gmail is free. Of course, they have ads and everything, but it's free. And so if you download Gmail through the App Store, then it's still functional. You could still do something with it. I agree. 30% is ridiculous. I saw Jason Fried's tweet that said, it was one of the only things that I heard him weigh in on about this.
I do wonder about what's happening between the two of them. If they're happy with each other right now, or if they've gone too far. Or
well, Jason made a good point. He was like, just don't include us in the search in iOS. Like, make us not discoverable at all.
We're fine with being discovered.
Just make it available. Like, we'll give our users a special link and they'll get to it.
So I think Apple's, where their argument falls apart is in the arbitrariness of the application of the rules. Right. So some get this and some get that. And there are a million different cases of people being treated differently than others. And I sympathize with that tremendously. There are always inside deals with any platform, some of it nefarious and some of it understandable. Like
they're talking about Netflix as the example of like, I don't believe Netflix is paying. I don't know how it works actually through the Netflix app, but they're saying like that's a good example of like, oh, they gave Netflix a special deal.
Right. There are always special deals, and some of it is understandable. If a platform is brand new and it's dying for a feature, then it might need to convince a company to come on board and give them, you know, a 10-year deal that's much better than others because they really need that feature for their customers.
Yeah. But it's something about like they classify it as like a reader. I don't know.
Right. But there are fairness issues and there are power issues.
So here's another question for me is like, all right, well, first of all, people are like accusing Basecamp of intentionally making this controversy happen, which I think is a little ridiculous.
I don't think so.
That didn't happen. But I sort of question like, how did they not see this coming? You know, like
maybe because they have an existing app and they're not paying and they're going to say, we're just going to do things the exact same way.
Because I mean,
that would be a reasonable assumption.
Having the iOS app is so important for this business to work. I would make sure that every question about the terms is buttoned up well before launch. And they were accepted before launch. But I read today in TechCrunch, Phil Schiller at Apple weighed in on it. And he was like, yeah, we're not changing any terms. It is what it is. that's that. Maybe I read this wrong, but he said in that article that Hey also tried to submit a Mac app to the Mac App Store. And that was rejected months ago.
For a desktop app?
Yeah, for the same reason, the in-app purchase reason.
Ooh, the plot thickens.
And I could be wrong about that, but that's what I read in the article about him today. And it said, and so then I'm like, well, if that happened, then it's like, it's a risky move, you know?
It is risky, but their risk is different. We have to acknowledge that. It doesn't matter whether they want to be treated like everyone else and not be punished for being successful. Their risk is different. Their calculations are very different. So I could see a situation where they went into this and said, there's a chance that it will have a problem, but we can look at our Basecamp app and that doesn't have a problem. We don't have to share. So we should launch with the assumption it'll be treated the same way as Basecamp. And at worst, if it gets treated differently, then we can use that for PR. That I think would be a reasonable way to think about it and something that's likely to have happened. The likeliness of them just never considering it and never talking about it at all when it's 30% and everyone knows it, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah, that's true. I'm a little bit more fuzzy on this part, but like there are things that they could do on the app to make them. And I think in that Phil Schiller article, he was like, these are the things that you could do. Like they could add like IMAP support so that it could read other email stuff, and then it becomes classified as like a reader that they don't have to pay for. And then I was thinking like, they could just offer a freemium plan for Hey, like super limited, make it like not even usable, but just basically usable so that users can download it for free through the App Store, and then that's fine. And then, but if you want all the real features, you go subscribe at Hey.
Yeah, or upgrade or something.
Maybe it's not that simple, but like.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation. I'm always up for a platform conversation. They're great in some ways. And, you know, Apple specifically has their gatekeepers to an unbelievable amount of value.
Yeah.
And
it is interesting to me though, because like I could certainly see a time in the somewhat near future that I do an iPhone app for Process Kit. Customers ask about it all the time. And we have a mobile optimized web version, which, you know, I save to the home screen and everything, and it works pretty well. But it's not an iPhone app.
It's different. Yeah. Yeah. We thought about building a reporting app just so people can look at their numbers and see conversion rate and see how things are going, get notifications. We would build that without even considering paying Apple 30%. That wouldn't make any sense to us.
Yeah. I think that yours and my apps would more be considered, well, yes. They would be considered business apps.
Right. Now, okay, cool. Business apps, don't pay anything. Great. How about next year they come out and say, you know what, business apps, now pay us 10%.
Yeah. Now you do. Yeah.
Yes.
And I don't have a free plan either. So it runs into the same issue as Hey. So it's like.
Yes. Again, if it is only a portion of the revenue generated by people who discovered it and signed up through the App Store, it's much harder to argue.
Yeah, if they had a way, but that they don't really have a way to track that attribution. You know, it's tricky.
Well, it'll be cool to see it unfold. It doesn't affect us financially, but it will be interesting if it ends up affecting us in a business sense, because you can see how Apple will catch the eye of regulators. I mean, they're obviously already in the eyes of regulators just because of the sheer size and power that they have. But Europe is more litigious on that front. Microsoft has already gone through their issues. And you can see how Apple could be targeted. And you can also see how a few years from now, regulators come down and restrict their ability to do this sort of thing. And that does affect us and a lot of other people.
Well, like there must be some public numbers on this about like how significant the App Store revenue is for Apple in terms of like their revenue share of apps compared to like among all their products. I mean, I know that they must make the most from their hardware, but like the services is like Apple's huge push in general. Like you keep hearing Tim Cook talk about like services. We're going big on services now. Apple Music and with Apple TV and stuff, and like with them taking 30% of App Store stuff, like that's significant for them. But then I wonder, like, how small is this controversy to Apple really right now? Because it must be like as big as Basecamp.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal.
And it's becoming a big deal. Like Basecamp is a big deal in. At least in our world, but beyond that as well.
Yeah, for sure.
But is this like a blip for Apple, or is
no
this
way.
They're taking like
no how the serious revenue is it? The revenue generated or lost on Basecamp or Hey is insignificant, but how it affects the
PR,
rest of the
I'm talking PR about like the PR
and pricing power, ecosystem regulation. That's huge. So Apple made $260 billion in revenue in 2019, of which $11.5 billion came from the App Store. That's my very quick Googling. Excuse me if I'm wrong, but generally speaking, you can see how it's a relatively small percentage of their revenue. But if you look out toward the future, it's very significant, right? Look over the next 10 years, it's over $100 billion in revenue. And their ability to charge 30%, compared to a regulator coming in and say, we think 8% is fair. That's a big deal.
And as small as this one Hey app is to them right now, I mean, DHH going on CNBC to talk about this or the New York Times or whatever is like, that must not be insignificant. I mean, Phil Schiller is taking interviews about it. Like it's going Absolutely. To the top,
right?
Like it's going to the top because it's going to Congress, right? DHH has testified in Congress before around these types of platform and monopoly issues. It's there. If it's popular with the public and if there's lobbying behind it, then congressmen can get on their high horse. That has results. That has real world implications. Right now, it seems to be more entertainment because you're looking at a company with infinity money and a company with, you know, Scrooge McDuck money. And they're arguing, but it does have repercussions and there's fairness. Infinity money, Jesus.
Yeah.
Hey.
Hey.
Ian, you keep it up, brother. You keep
That's
it
for
up.
For you, buddy.
So Brian, what's going on in our businesses? You know, bring it back down to earth here.
Just trying to submit an app to the App Store and like, no. I got a couple things. What do you got?
The big thing is hiring. And I talked about hiring over the past few weeks, but the way I put it to my team was that it's time to put our bets down. So when the crisis hit, we went careful. We didn't expand expenses, we cut unnecessary expenses, and we just sat tight. And we played it conservative. I don't know what else would make sense. But overall, the COVID e-commerce boom helped us. And so we've grown, and we just kept expenses in check for a few months. And we've just been really careful. And now it's time to make investments. And so that's what we're doing on the hiring front. We're not hiring one or two. We're hiring like eight. Right. So we hired two people recently. We hired a support engineer in Los Angeles, first fully remote hire, at least in the past year. And we hired a backend engineer in Austria. So going through the process of those two really showed us how much work it takes to recruit and hire properly. And now that we're done with that part, one is joining on Monday. The other one joins on August 1st. And now we're about to experience what onboarding a new employee looks like. And so the two people responsible for those hires, I spoke with both of them and I just checked in and said, look, what did that do to your workload? And they both said completely obliterated 2 weeks because putting it out there, writing the job ad, dealing with 200 applicants, giving them a good experience, being polite about responding to people who aren't a good fit, all that, it is a lot of work. So then we look at eight more roles and there's no way we can do that internally. So then we start to weigh our options around recruiting. And traditional recruiting doesn't feel like it makes that much sense in our situation because we don't need that much help finding candidates.
Yeah, you said this on the last episode where it's like finding them is not the issue. It's just
right.
Managing the funnel.
Yes. So when you're paying a traditional recruiter 15 to 20% of an annual salary, which is significant, right? It's 10 to 20K. A lot of the service, a lot of the value is in them going on finding amazing people. This is more like you have to filter to find the amazing people. So we've been looking at our options on what to do about that. But one thing that we come to the conclusion of is taking a 15 to 20% recruiter, multiplying that by eight, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. Because that's now starting to get into the 75 to 100K range for recruiting. And then we still don't have any help on helping them onboard. So I'm starting to get into a place where it might make sense to hire a people ops person. And that person can ideally help with the recruiting process of filtering through and working with the individual team leads for that particular area in helping filter through. But then you start to see where the real value is how are we going to give eight people at the same time a great onboarding experience? How do we keep the team from feeling isolated? There's a large portion of the company right now that know each other. We've eaten lunch together. We've gone out together. We know each other's families. We talk about what we're cooking on the weekends. We have relationships. Now we have eight completely new people coming in we've never met. We probably won't see in person for like a year. How do we give them a good experience? How do we make sure they don't feel isolated? How do we keep these cultural parts of the company moving forward and developing?
Yeah. Not just the cultural onboarding, but the training. right?
Or training the first 30 days, first week.
Yeah.
There's a lot that goes into it, man. We just hired someone in LA. There's a lot of time. Like I'm on Amazon and I'm figuring out what equipment to send them. And then we're talking to them and saying, what mouse do you want? And just, there's a lot. Multiply that by 8, it becomes a lot of work. And then you start to look at the first 60 days, 90 days, first year. And then you start to look at our existing company and it really starts to make sense. Let's take that recruiting budget and move it over to a people ops, right? Someone who's going to be thinking about that.
I think it does make sense, especially if you're hiring that many people and you still need to hire the people ops person and get them onboarding, like we were just talking about. And I think it's even more of an onboarding for them because they have to learn all the different parts of the company that they will be onboarding other people into. So it's a whole process in itself just to get that person on. So then the question is like, well, how urgent is it to get the 8 people on?
So yeah, you're on the money, right? What we had to do was look at that and say, cool story on the people ops person. We need these 2 people immediately.
Yeah.
And so for that, we are working with not Ian Landsman, but Ian from Tropical MBA and in his company called Dynamite Jobs.
Oh, very cool. I was just listening to them today. I haven't been tuning in much this year, but they did their 2020 goals episode and talking about Dynamite Jobs. It was a good one.
Yes. So we are working with Dynamite Jobs because they were able to accommodate our version of recruiting needs, which is about the filtering and the process and taking it down from 200 applications and getting it down to the top 3 or 4 engineers. So we're moving forward with them with the first 2 roles immediately and then starting to look for a people ops person in the meantime.
That's an interesting that they're offering that service with Dynamite Jobs.
It's pretty cool. We talked about this being a potential productized service. Yeah, I was very happy to find them. I think he reached out over Twitter after seeing a tweet I wrote about this topic. So I'll report back on how that goes. And, you know, it might be that we do both. It might be that we work with them for all of the roles and bring in a people ops person because I now see the value in that independent of the recruiting. So maybe the ideal is they're all bundled. But even if they're not all bundled, if we can work with Dynamite Jobs that doesn't do the 15 to 20% of annual salary, it's more reasonable than that. And we can get a people ops person, then I'm starting to see, okay, this is what the next few months is going to look like. Here's how we'll find people. Here's how we'll make sure that it doesn't annihilate individual team members' time in order to find those people and bring them on. And then starting to see what it would look like to actually give people the feeling of an organized company.
right.
Yes.
I could see the people ops person also. Well, then it's sort of like a question of like, do you fully break out the recruiting, the marketing of Carthook Jobs from the internal people ops of onboarding and dealing with, you know, companies who really invest in hiring a lot of people over all the time. Like, they have people who just go out to conferences and they're recruiting and they're marketing for talent, right?
Yes. We're not in that position yet, right? I could see a situation where we hire these people over the next 3 months and then we don't hire other people for 6 months until after Q4. Right? Q4 is the big one for us. We get ramped up for that. And then the holidays go through. And then January, we pick our heads back up and start thinking about the future again. So we could hire and then from September to January, not hire anyone. I'm excited about it. It'll be interesting to see. Definitely have some stress around putting that big of a bet down.
right.
But I'm trying to train myself in this environment to be more comfortable making decisions with less information. That's kind of how I put it to my team. My team knows I like pretend to be cowboy, but I'm pretty conservative on risk. What that really means is you don't make these big bets without a lot of information and feeling very confident about it. And now it feels like I have to dial that back and be able to make these decisions with less information. It's just kind of the environment that we're in.
I mean, that's what it's all about, is making decisions with little or incomplete information.
Right. If you wait to have 100%, right, that never happens. If you wait for 90 or 80, it just feels like, but we get it to like 60 and then just pull the trigger.
Yep. That's how it works. Speaking of that, I think that's a good segue because the thing, okay, maybe nothing I say on this podcast ever makes sense.
But to us, it makes sense, and that's what matters. Thanks, everybody.
But I think that this one is really more of like a mental game question and an issue with bootstrapping a business, right? And it's also around being a solo founder and being a solo maker founder. I'm learning this week. I've learned this 100 times in the past. It's sort of a thing that I keep having to relearn, I think, is that the question on my mind this week was, do I build this next very big feature in Process Kit, or do I do what I thought I was planning on doing, which is diving headfirst into marketing for Process Kit? And now I've done some marketing activities, like created the free course, a lot of content. I've been tweeting, I've been promoting to my audience and things like that. But all of that stuff is a little bit more like groundwork stuff, like not really like building out marketing funnels and ramping up spending on marketing activities and doing things like ads and whatever else. Like, there's a lot more that I want to do when it comes to marketing. And my plan was, since now I'm wrapping up a lot of my work on the onboarding work on Process Kit, I talked about that last time, I'm feeling more and more ready to put this thing to the test, right? Like, the trial to paid conversion rate has been slowly improving. It's not quite where I would like it to be, but it's been inching up over the last few months. And I think that these onboarding changes are helping with that. I think they will help more with that. And I feel like I've brought it as far as I could with my audience. I need to really get exposure from cold traffic, you know, and we get some cold traffic from like organic search is starting to come in and things like that. And we convert some of them, but then some of them we don't. And I have this hypothesis that some of my trial to paid conversion rate is being depressed due to the audience factor. You know, some people may be just kicking the tires and they're not actually ready to commit. There's this other big feature that has been sitting on the GitHub board for many months now, and it's been in the plans, and essentially it's forms. We have some various forms features already in Process Kit, but what customers ask a lot about is, can I put forms on individual tasks or individual steps in a process?
Forms as in, this task requires me to collect this information and let me build a form so that it's easy for me or my employees to input that information for this stage of the process.
Exactly. Inputting things into a step in a process. Like, a step currently is just a checkbox and a lot of information about it.
Okay, how is it done now? They're collecting the information somewhere else and then identifying that that task has been done?
Yeah. We have things like custom form fields on the project level, but not on the individual task level. We also have custom form fields on clients. We call them client attributes, and those are attached to projects as well. So there's all these like little pieces of data that can come in over there. But on the individual tasks, which is where the work is happening, like I'm up to the fourth step in our new hire onboarding process.
That's the only thing you care about right now.
Yeah. And so on that step, they want to have input fields. Like, let me input this candidate's email address, or this candidate is from Europe, not United States. So let's check that box and not the United States box. And by doing that on the task level, now step five in the process can automate. It can have conditional logic based on, oh, for European candidates, these next three steps are relevant, but these steps are not. Like, so we have conditional logic already in Process Kit, which can work off of a bunch of criteria, but intake forms or inputting data into the individual steps is something that people ask a lot about.
So now you're being faced with the hard decision on, do I build that thing or do I start marketing?
Yeah. Now I have a developer that has been working with me, and we've really gotten to I'm so psyched about this, that we have this super fast shipping workflow. We are shipping features like crazy. Just this week we shipped like propagation of tasks, like all this cool stuff. And we can go super fast when it's a feature that he can build on top of existing UI. So like if we've already built other functionality in the app that uses the same button style, the same menu style, you just have to add a new button to it and then some functionality underneath it. I can spend 1 hour of my time speccing it and then he does the rest of it. But when it's a feature like this forms feature, which will require some newly designed UI stuff built into the app, then that means I'm going to need to spend more of my time. But this is where it gets into the mental thing as a solo maker founder, because this feels like a really big feature. And compared to all of our other features, we've already shipped some really big features. This is up there. Maybe not the biggest feature, but it's in the top five of like the biggest, hairiest features that we would design and build into the app.
And can you box that into like a time frame? Is that like a month?
Well, I started to analyze that this week, right? Mm-hmm. When it's just in thought, it actually feels a lot bigger than it is in reality. At least in my
depends. It can go either way.
So exactly. I know. Like everybody always says like, oh, we always underestimate how long tech takes, right? Yes. But I'm not kidding around here. So those top five big hairy features that we've already shipped in Process Kit. So for example, Kanban boards. We've recreated what you can do with like a Trello board inside Process Kit. That required brand new UI design from me. And then I handed the functionality off to my developer. Reality, very first issue in GitHub for that feature to the day that it shipped live to the app was like under 20 days. You know?
Okay. So big hairy feature can be relatively limited in scope.
The biggest features we've shipped took us about 20 to 22 days. Like conditional logic.
Our biggest features are 6 months.
Yeah.
And things that we've screwed up and had to go back. And
conditional logic was like 15 days start to finish. Like the reason why these go so fast is because we're not building a whole new app. We're just adding a significant feature to the app, right? And we have tests, complete test coverage over everything, right? And that also helps with speed now because we don't have to fix a lot of bugs. But like when I was thinking about it in theory, I was like, this thing feels so big, this custom forms builder. Like
it's going to delay marketing even more. And then you start to
get into that's mental. What I start to think about it. But like before I analyzed like how long those previous features took, I was thinking like, oh, this is why I've been procrastinating, like not even starting this feature, is because this feels like a 2 month, a 3 month, maybe a 4 month feature, because it feels that big in my mind. But there has never been a 4 month feature in Process Kit, you know?
Yep, not yet.
It's just, I know, not yet, but it's just me and a developer. Good. And we are fast
as you'll ever be.
Yeah, that's right. And so I'm starting to realize that in reality, I could just spend next week. Say I give myself all of next week.
Right. Do the UX, do the UI handoff.
Do the UI, start the feature, scope it out, spec it out, and hand it off. Then it's just 1 week of my time. Then he's going to spend about 2 weeks building it and writing the tests. And then I'm going to do some QA on that. We'll have a little bit of back and forth later. But I could get to the marketing 2 weeks from now after I do the 1 week of the UI work. And when I say get to marketing, I mean like probably like fire up some Google ad campaigns. And I said that in one sentence, but we all know that that's like a whole week of work.
At least. That's right. That's right. Every step you take, you realize you need three more tasks to complete that step and then go backward to the other step and readjust the tracking. And
yep. Yeah. And then the other thing about marketing is that it's you got to track it. You got to improve it. It's not going to work right away. You've got to figure it out. You got to test all those different things. And
you don't have a platform for distribution. So,
right. And it's not my strong suit, to be honest. Like ads is certainly not, you know. I might need to hire a consultant to work with me on that. Like, here's why I felt like it was a dilemma this week, was that like I'm constantly wary of that thing that we all fall into, is like, oh, I'll get to marketing once I build one more thing. And so I wanted to do a gut check on myself on that. I guess I'm doing it here on the podcast now, but I took it to my mastermind group this week. I do feel like this feature is super important because I don't have like hard quantifiable data, but gut is like, it comes up in 80% of my conversations with customers. And one guy flat out told me, I will convert once you have that feature. I can't convert until you have that feature. I'm talking about one guy this week. I've heard that from other people as well, but it's unclear exactly. Was that the deal breaker or was there something else?
It's tough.
It comes up a lot. And the other thing is that a couple of competitors have this ability and a large number of the people that I talk to are switching from those competitors. And they're like, if I'm going to switch, I have to have that parity.
Okay. So you do have a decent amount of information around its significance and the fact that it'll be used. It's impossible to tell how it'll actually be used and if and how much before, regardless of what people say, but you do have a decent amount of information, which I think is where the conversation started. How much information do you need before making the decision? And I know for me, and this is not me lecturing, this is me sympathizing because I have the same issue. It's the torture internally over the decision that's really the enemy. You know, it's should I do this? Should I feel guilty? But I told myself I would do this and I didn't do marketing. I said by this date I would do it, but I didn't. And now I don't know what to do. It's like that is exhausting and just eats energy.
It's the, I told myself I would do it by this date and now I'm changing that plan. Why am I changing that plan? You know?
Yes. Guilt, for me, guilt is the enemy. It clouds things instead of clarifies. It is like walking around viewing everything through a sunk cost fallacy. Everything at all times, as opposed to just almost being a little less thoughtful and just saying, that makes sense to me, go.
I hope other people can relate to this. And sometimes I feel like I'm a little bit, here's the thing. I'm a solo founder. I have no partners. And I'm a maker founder. By my nature, I'm going to do the design work on the app. Like to me, like outsourcing the design of this UI is not an option. Not today, it's not. In the future, of course, we're going to have team members who do this sort of thing.
Not now.
Not right now. I'm the designer. I'm designing this product. That's my job. My job is also to market this product, you know? Sometimes when I take this question to people, the response is like, okay, well, would money solve this problem? And do you take money and hire somebody to do it so that you could focus on one thing or the other? And look, I have cash. I could hire someone for either of these if I wanted to right now. But to me, that's not an option. Not right now.
To just throw money at it. It's not one of those problems.
No,
the advertising might be one of those problems. But
maybe,
the decision,
maybe, but still the advertising is like messaging and positioning and marketing right. Creative. And
a lot of it can't be outsourced.
Yeah. A lot. Like, so even if I outsource, I need to work with the outsourced person on that stuff. So I get back to this thing where it's like, I'm a solo maker founder. So I have to do all these things. I just have to sort of accept that like next week is going to be UI work instead of marketing work. And then the week after that is when I'm going to do marketing. You know,
so it's like, so the trade-offs hurt more, right? Cause I hear you, you're viewing it as like, you're trying to be realistic. I'm the maker and marketer. I have to do both. And so the trade-off is just going to hurt because you can't do everything at the same time. I want to bring it down to the level of, do we go for product market fit first and be certain that this is exactly what people want? We got it, then start marketing, right? If you had $3 million in the bank right now, you could see that as like you're not in a rush. You want to get it right. And then you could throw firepower behind it. Right. The other way to do it is to just, I don't know, I want to bring it down to that level on the debate on, do you have what people want yet?
Well, that's a really good question. That's also why I struggle with this question, because I have customers and growing customers. We're growing again this month. So I very well could just go with market now. Market now, build later.
It's healthy to have that as the opposing argument. I say it to my team a lot.
Well, that was my plan, right? My plan was like, I know the forms feature is sitting on the board. We're going to get to it sometime later in the year. But people are paying right now. So let's just get more of those people.
That was
my plan.
Yes.
But I'm doing more demo calls and this question comes up in 80% of them. And some people still do convert, but a lot of people don't convert. So I don't know for sure, numbers wise, exactly how much of a deal breaker this is. All I do know is that having this is that I'm constantly answering the question like, I know you asked about the forms feature. It's coming. Believe me, it's coming. Look, both need to happen. It's just a question of when. If it's a question of when, it's like, okay, I could look at the forms feature and I see 3 weeks out of the calendar. 1 week of my work, 2 weeks of his work, and I'll input on his work. And I see marketing, and that doesn't fit into a 3 week box. That's going to be a year long, multi-year. Yeah,
forever.
That's going to be a forever effort. So it's like, at some point, I'm going to need to do this, you know, like, because marketing has to happen all the time, but feature development has to happen all the time. So it's like,
I mean, you're going to build the feature. Right. And I'm a big proponent of going with your gut at this stage, as opposed to looking at the numbers and trying to decipher the exact number of people that converted versus not and talking to them. And I see the value in that. And some people go that way. That's not how I do it. So it's up to you, but it sounds a lot like you want to build the feature. I think you go with it. And then what I would do is I would say to myself, am I going to make a deal with myself? Or am I going to go all the way in? Am I going to say, I'm doing this feature and then we're going to do marketing? Or do I make a deal with myself? Do I say, I'm going to do this feature, but I'm going to have 3 calls next week with potential ad agencies. So I feel like I'm making some progress on the marketing while doing
this. Right. Yeah. So here's the other thing about that. Like yes, of course, it sounds like I want to build the feature instead of do the marketing work. That's probably true on a day-to-day basis. But I would say at an equal level, is my frustration at MRR needs to be 10x what it is today. And it needs to get there sooner.
Look, MRR always needs the 10x, but the question is by when?
Exactly. So I've had this number in my mind for like the end of 2020, and it's been growing. MRR has been growing every month, but it's not growing at the rate that I want to see it. And so there's this anxious level of like, I should be working on ramping up these marketing channels to accelerate that MRR growth. But then part of me is like, actually having this feature would also accelerate conversion rates. And
there's nothing better than the conversion rate being very good, because that just helps. That means you're going to grow naturally. And when you do marketing, it's more effective, right? For the first year, I can't even talk about how brutal that was, but our conversion rates, our conversion rate was fine, but our retention rate was horrible. So it was a matter of, it doesn't matter what we're doing. This is not going to work out unless we improve them. So for us, it was churn. For you, it's conversion. From the outside, it looked like we went from 20K to 80K MRR in a year. And I was 100% certain the company was going to die if we stayed on that trajectory. So it didn't matter. We had to improve churn. For you, even if your marketing efforts improve, it's not really going to work out unless you convert people at a high rate.
Yeah. And you know, it's weird that I'm even like stressing out over this question, because it's like, we've been continuously developing features, me and my developer. So that's nothing new. You know, we're shipping stuff literally every single week. The thing that's given me this hang up is that a month ago, I told myself that by the end of this month, I'm going to start working on marketing. And now I'm talking about pushing that off like 1 or 2 more weeks. And that's like, what am I doing? You know, but then it's like, what else is my developer going to work on? He's been working on some like optimizations, speed optimizations, and smaller features that don't take up a lot of my time, but I need him to be productive on big, good features, you know? So. Yeah.
All right. Well, we don't have an answer for you, Brian, but hopefully just talking through it forces you to articulate your feelings. And I think if nothing else, what's bubbled up from the surface is your desire to take on the feature. And now you're wrestling with yourself and how you prioritized and what you committed to. And
I think it's pretty clear. I've decided I'm going to be building the feature probably starting next week. And,
yes.
And then turn to marketing. And then 2 weeks from now, I'll come on here again and talk about why I'm going to delay marketing another 2 weeks. And then it's going to be a forever cycle. So.
As long as you're growing.
All right, man.
Well, thanks, everybody. Hey, hey out there. Good luck in the platform wars.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Take it easy, Brian.
Later, folks.